Rincewind grinned glassily. So, you're a crocodile, then?
Is worrying you?
Said the barman. No, don't they call you anything else, though?
Well, they've a nickname they gave me.
Oh, yes?
Yeah. Crocodile. But in here, most people call me Dongo.
And, this stuff, what do you call this?
We call it beer,
said the crocodile.
What do you call it?
The barman wore a grubby shirt and a pair of shorts, and until he'd seen a pair of shorts tailored for someone with very short legs and a very long tail, Rincewind hadn't realized what a difficult job tailoring must be. Rincewind held the beer glass up to the light. And that was the point. You could see light all the way through it. Clear beer. Ankh-Morpork beer was technically ale, that is to say, gravy made from hops. It had texture. It had flavour, even if you didn't always want to know what of. It had body. It had dregs. You could eat the last half inch of it with a spoon. This stuff was thin and sparkly, and looked as though someone had already drunk it. Tasted all right, though. Didn't sit on your stomach the way the beer at home did. Weak stuff, of course. But it never did to insult someone else's beer. Pretty good, he said.
Where'd you fly in from?
I floated here on a piece of driftwood.
Was there room with all the camels?
Yes.
Good on ya.
Rincewind needed a map. Not a geographical map, although one of those would be a help, but one that showed him where his head was at. You didn't usually get crocodiles serving behind a bar, but everyone else in this cavern of a place seemed to think it was perfectly normal. Mind you, the people in the bar included 3 sheep in overalls and a couple of kangaroos playing darts. And they weren't exactly sheep. They looked more like, well, human sheep. Sticking out ears, white curls, a definite sheepish look, but standing upright with hands. And he was pretty sure that there was no way you could get a cross between a human and a sheep. If there was, people would definitely have found out by now, especially in the more isolated rural districts. Something similar had happened with the kangaroos. There were the pointy ears, and they definitely had snouts, but now they were leaning on the bar drinking this thin, strange beer. One of them was wearing a stained vest with the legend, "Wagga Hay, it's the rye grass," just visible under the dirt. In short, Rincewind had the feeling he wasn't looking at animals at all. He took another sip of the beer. He couldn't raise the subject with Crocodile Dongo. There was a philosophical wrongness about drawing a crocodile's attention to the fact that there were a couple of kangaroos in the bar.
"Yous want another beer?"
said Dongo.
"Yeah, right," said Rincewind.
He looked at the sign on the beer pump. It was a picture of a grinning kangaroo. The label said, "Roo Beer." He raised his eyes to a torn poster on the wall. It also advertised Roo Beer. It was the same kangaroo holding a pint of said beer and wearing the same knowing grin. It looked familiar for some reason. "I can't help noticing," he tried again, "I can't help noticing," he said, "that some people in this bar are a different chap from other people."
"Well, old Hollowlock Joe over there have put on a bit weight lately," said Dongo, polishing a glass.
Rincewind looked down at his legs.
"Whose legs are these? You okay, mister?"
"Probably been bitten by something," said Rincewind.
A sudden urgent need gripped him.
"If out the back," said Dongo.
"Out back in the outback," said Rincewind, staggering forward.
He walked into an iron pillar, which picked him up in a fist and held him at arm's length. He looked along the arm to a large, angry face and an expression that said a lot of beer was looking for a fight, and the rest of the body was happy to go along with it. Rincewind was muzzily aware that in this case a lot of beer wanted to run away, and at a time like this it's always the beer talking.
"I've been listening to you. Where you from, mister?" said the giant's beer.
Ankh-Morpork. At a time like this, why lie? The bar went quiet.
"And you're going to come here and make a lot of cracks about us all drinking beer and fighting and talking funny, right?"
Some of Rincewind's beer said, "No worries," His captor pulled him so they were face to face. Rincewind had never seen such a huge nose.
"And I expect you don't even know that we happen to produce some particularly fine wines. Our Chardonnay's been specially worthy of attention and competitively priced, not to mention the rich, firmly structured, rusty Dunny Valley Semillions, which are a tangily refreshing discovery for the connoisseur, you bastard."
Jolly good. I'll have a pint of Chardonnay, please."
"You taking a piss?"
"No, I'd like to leave it here."
"How about you putting my mate down?"
said a voice. Mad was in the doorway. There was a general scuffle to get out of the way.
"Oh, you looking for a fight too, Stubby?"
Rincewind was dropped as the huge creature turned to face the dwarf, fists clenching.
"I don't look for them. I just walk into pubs and there they are,"
said Mad, pulling out a knife.
"Now you gonna leave him alone, Wally?"
"You call that a knife?"
The giant unsheathed one that would be called a sword if it had been held in a normal-sized hand.
"This is what I call a knife."
Mad looked at it, then he reached his hand around behind his back, and it came back holding something.
"Really? No worries. This," he said, "is what I call a crossbow."
"It's a log," said Ridcully, inspecting the boat building committee's work to date.
"Rather more than a log," the dean began.
Oh, you've made a mast and tied the bursar's bathrobe to it, I can see that.
It's a log, dean. There's roots on one end and bits of branch at the other. You haven't even hollowed it out.
It's a log.
It took us all hours," said the senior wrangler.
"And it does float,"
the dean pointed out.
"I think the term is more like wallows," said Ridcully. "And we'd all get on it, would we?"
"This is the one-man version," said the dean. "We thought we'd test it out and then try it with a lot of them together."
"Oh, like a raft, you mean?"
"I suppose so," said the dean with considerable reluctance. He would have preferred a more dynamic name for it.
"Obviously these things take time."
The Arch-Chancellor nodded. He was impressed in a strange way. The wizards had succeeded in recapitulating in a mere day a technological development that had probably taken mankind several hundred years. They might be up to coracles by Tuesday.
Which of you is going to test it?" he said.
We thought perhaps the bursar could assist at this point in the development program."
"Volunteered, has he?"
"We're sure he will."
In fact, the bursar was some distance away, wandering aimlessly but happily through the beetle-filled jungle. The bursar was, as he would probably be the first to admit, not the most mentally stable of people. He would probably be the first to admit that he was a tea-strainer. But he was, as it were, only insane on the outside. He'd never been very interested in magic as a boy, but he had been good at numbers. And even somewhere like Unseen University needed someone who could add up. And he had indeed survived many otherwise exciting years by locking himself in a room somewhere and conscientiously adding up, while some very serious division and subtraction was going on outside. Those were still the days when magical assassination was still a preferred and legal route to high office, but he'd been quite safe because no one had wanted to be a bursar. Then Mustrum Ridcully had been appointed, and he'd put a stop to the whole business by being unkillable, and had been in his own strange way a moderniser. And the senior wizards had gone along with him because he tended to shout at them if they didn't, and it was, after some exhilarating times in the university's history, something of a relief to enjoy your dinner without having to watch someone else eat a bit of it first, or having to check your shape the moment you got out of bed. But it was hell for the bursar. Everything about Mustrum Ridcully rasped across his nerves. If people were food, the bursar would have been one of life's lightly poached eggs. But Mustrum Ridcully was a rich suet pudding with garlic gravy. He spoke as loudly as most people shouted. He stamped instead of walking. He roared around the place and lost important bits of paper which he then denied he'd ever seen, and shot his crossbow at the wall when he was bored. He was aggressively cheerful. never sick himself, he tended to the belief that sickness in other people was caused by sloppy thinking. And he had no sense of humour. And he told jokes. It was odd that this affected the bursar so much, since he did not have a sense of humour either. He was proud of it. He was not the kind of man to laugh, but he did know, in a mechanical sort of way, how jokes were supposed to go. Ridcully told jokes like a bullfrog did accountancy. They never added up. So the bursar found it much more satisfying to live inside his own head, where he didn't have to listen, and where there were clouds and flowers. Even so, something must have filtered in from the world outside, because occasionally he'd jump up and down on an ant, just in case he was supposed to. Part of him rather hoped that one of the ants was, in some unimaginably distant way, related to Mustrum Ridcully. It was while he was thus engaged in changing the future that he noticed what looked like a very thick green hosepipe on the ground. Ooh! It was slightly transparent and seemed to be pulsating rhythmically. When he put his ear to it, he heard a sound like gloop. Mildly deranged though he was, the bursar had the true wizard's instinct to amble aimlessly into dangerous places, so he followed the throbbing stem. Rincewind awoke, because sleep was so hard with someone kicking him in the ribs.
Wizard, you want I should pour a bucket of water on yez?
Rincewind recognized the chatty tones, his eyes unglued.
Oh, not you. You're a figment of my imagination.
I should kick you in the ribs again, then? Said Scrappy.
Rincewind pulled himself upright. It was dawn, and he was lying in some bushes out behind the pub. Memory played its silent movie across the tattered sheets of his eyelids.
There was a fight. Mad shot that shot him with a crossbow.
I only threw the foot so he'd stand still to be hit. Wombats can't hold their drink, that's their trouble.
More recollections flickered across the smoky darkness of Rincewind's brain.
That's right, there were animals drinking in there.
Yes and no, said the kangaroo. I tried to explain.
I'm all ears, said Rincewind. His eyes glazed for a moment. No, I'm not, I'm all bladder. Back in a minute.
The buzz of flies and a sort of universal smell drew Rincewind into a nearby hut. Some people would have liked to think of it as the bathroom, although not after going inside. He came out again, hopping up and down urgently.
There's a great big spider on the toilet seat.
What you gonna do? Wait till it's finished? Fan it with your hat.
It was odd, Rincewind thought, as he shooed the spider out, that a human being would, use the bathroom behind a bush in the middle of 1,000 miles of howling wilderness, but would fight for a dunny if there was one available. And stay out, he muttered, when he was confident the spider was out of earshot. But the human brain often feels incapable of concentrating on the job in hand, and Rincewind found his gaze wandering. And here, as in private places everywhere, men had found the urge to draw on the walls. Perhaps it was the way the light hit the ancient woodwork, but under the usual minutiae from people who needed people, and drawings done from overheated hope rather than memory, was a deeply scored drawing of men in pointy hats. He sidled out thoughtfully and edged away through the bushes.
No worries, said the kangaroo,
so close to his ear that Rincewind was quite pleased that he'd already relieved himself.
I don't believe it.
You'll see them everywhere. They're built in. They find their way into people's thoughts. You can't outrun your destiny, mate.
Rincewind didn't even bother to argue.
You're going to have to sort this out, said Scrappy. You're the cause.
I'm not. Things happen to me, not the other way round.
I could disembowel you with a kick, you know. Would you like to see?
No.
Haven't you noticed that by running away you end up in more trouble?
Yes, but you see, you can run away from that, too, said Rincewind. That's the beauty of the system. Dead is only for once, but running away is forever.
Ah, but it is said that a coward dies 1,000 deaths while a hero dies only one.
Yes, but it's the important one.
Aren't you ashamed?
No, I'm going home. I'm going to find this city called Bugger Up, find a boat and go home.
Bugger Up?
Don't tell me the place doesn't exist.
Ah, no, it's a big place. And that's where you're going?
And don't try to stop me.
I can see you made up your mind, said Scrappy.
Read my lips.
Your moustache is in the way.
Read my beard, then.
The kangaroo shrugged.
In that case, I've got no choice but to carry on helping you, I suppose.
Rincewind drew himself up.
I'll find my own way, he said.
You don't know the way.
I'll ask someone.
What about food? You'll starve.
Ah, that's where you're wrong, Rincewind snapped. I've got this amazing power. Watch. He lifted up a nearby stone, extracted what was underneath, and flourished it.
See? Impressed, eh?
Very.
Aha. Scrappy nodded.
I've never seen anyone do that with a scorpion before.
The god was sitting high up in a tree, working on a particularly promising beetle, when the bursar ambled past far below. Well, at last, one of them had found it. The god had spent some time watching the wizard's attempts at boat building, although he had been unable to fathom out what it was they were trying to do. As far as he could tell, they were showing some interest in the fact that wood floated. Well, it did float, didn't it? He threw the beetle into the air. It hummed into life at the top of the arc and flew away, a smear of iridescence among the treetops. The god drifted out of his tree and followed the bursar. The god hadn't made up his mind about these creatures yet, but the island was, unfortunately, and against all his careful planning, throwing up all sorts of odd things. These were obviously social creatures, with some of the individuals designed for specific tasks. The hairy red one was designed for climbing trees, and the dreamy ant-stamping one for walking into them. Possibly the reasons for this would become apparent.
"Ah, bursar," said the dean heartily. "How would you like a brief trip round the lagoon?"
The bursar looked at the soaking log and sought for words. Sometimes, when he really needed to, it was possible to get Mr. Brain and Mr. Mouth all lined up together.
"I had a boat once," he said.
"Well done. And here's another one, just for..."
"It was green."
"Really? Well, we can..."
"I found another green boat," said the bursar. "It's floating in the water."
"Yes, yes, I'm sure you have," said Ridcully kindly. "A big boat with lots of sails, I expect. Now then, Dean."
"Just one sail," said the bursar, "and a bare, naked lady on the front."
Hovering imminently, the god cursed. He'd never intended the figurehead. Sometimes he really wanted to just break down and cry.
"Bare, naked lady?" said the dean.
"Settle down, Dean," said the senior wrangler. "He's probably just had too many dried frog pills."
"It's going up and down in the water," said the bursar. "Up and down, up and down."
The dean looked at their own creation. Contrary to all expectations, it did not go up and down in the water. It stayed exactly where it was, and the water went up and down over it.
"This is an island," he said. "I suppose someone could have sailed here, couldn't they? What kind of bare naked lady? A dusky one?"
"Really, Dean?"
"Spirit of inquiry, senior angler. Important biogeographical information."
The bursar waited until his brain came round again.
"Green,"
he volunteered.
"That is not a natural colour for a human being, clothed or not," said the senior wrangler.
"She might be seasick," said the dean.
There was only the vaguest of wistful longings in his head, but he did not want to let go of it.
"Going up and down," said the bursar.
"I suppose we could have a look," said the dean. "What about Mrs. Whitlow? She hasn't been out of her hut yet."
"She can come too if she likes," said the dean.
"I don't think we can expect Mrs. Whitlow to go looking at a bare, naked lady, even if this one is green," said the senior wrangler.
"Why not? She must have seen at least one. Not green, of course."
The senior wrangler drew himself up.
"There's no call for that sort of imputation," he said.
"What?" "Well, obviously she..."
The dean stopped. The big leaves on Mrs. Whitlow's hut were pushed aside and she emerged. It was probably the flower in her hair. That was certainly the crowning glory. But she'd also done things to her dress. There was, for a start, less of it. Since the word is derived from an island that did not exist on the Discworld, the wizards had never heard of a bikini. In any case, what Mrs. Whitlow had sewn together out of her dress was a lot more substantial than a bikini. It was more a New Zealand. Two quite large, respectable halves, separated by a narrow channel. She had also tied some of the spare cloth around her waist, sarong style. In short, it was a very proper item of clothing, but it looked as if it wasn't. It was as if Mrs. Whitlow was wearing a fig leaf 6 feet square. It was still just a fig leaf. "I thought this might be a little more suitable for the heat," she said. "Of course, I wouldn't dream of wearing it in the university, but since we appear to be here for a little while, I remembered a picture I saw of Queen Zazumba of Sumtree. Is there any way I could have a bath, do you think?"
said the senior wrangler. The dean coughed.
"There is a little pool in the jungle."
"With water lilies in it," said the chair of indefinite studies. "Pink ones,"
said the senior wrangler.
"And there's a waterfall," said the dean.
"And a soap bush, as a matter of fact."
They watched her walk away.
"Up and down, up and down," said the bursar.
"A fine figure of a woman," said Ridcully. "She walks differently without her shoes on, doesn't she? Are you all right, senior wrangler?"
"I think the heat's getting to you. You've gone very red."
Oh, gosh, it is hot, isn't it? I think perhaps I should have a dip, too."
"In the lagoon," said Ridcully meaningfully.
The salt is very bad for the skin, Arch-Chancellor."
"Quite so. Nevertheless, or you can go looking for the pool when Mrs. Whitlow comes back."
"I find it rather insulting, Arch-Chancellor, that you should appear to think that..."
"Well done," said Ridcully. "Now, shall we go and look at this boat?"
Half an hour later, all the wizards were assembled on the opposite shore. It was green, and it bobbed up and down. It was clearly a ship, but built perhaps by someone who'd had a very detailed book of shipbuilding, which nevertheless didn't have any pictures in it. There was a blurriness of the detail. The figurehead, for example, was certainly vaguely female, although to the dean's disappointment it had the same detail as a half-sucked jelly baby. It put the senior wrangler in mind of Mrs. Whitlow, although currently rocks, trees, clouds and coconuts also reminded him of Mrs. Whitlow. And then there was the sail. It was, without a shadow of a doubt, a leaf. And once you realised that it was a leaf, then a certain marrow or pumpkin quality about the rest of the vessel began to creep over you. Ponder coughed.
"There are some plants which rely for propagation on floating seeds," he said in a small voice. "The common coconut, for example, has..."
"Does it have a figurehead?" said Ridcully.
One variety of mangrove fruit has a sort of keel, which..."
"And a sail, with what looks very much like rigging?" said Ridcully.
No.
"And what are those flowers on the top?" Ridcully demanded.
Where a crow's nest would be was a cluster of trumpet-shaped flowers, like green daffodils.
"Who cares?" said the chair of indefinite studies. "It's a ship, even if it is a giant pumpkin, and it looks as though there's room for all of us."
He brightened up.
"Even if it is a bit of a squash," he added.
"It has appeared very fortuitously," said Ridcully. "I wonder why."
"I said, even if it is a bit of a squash," said the chair of indefinite studies, "because a squash, you see, is another name for..."
"Yes, I know,"
said Ridcully, looking thoughtfully at the bobbing vessel.
"I was only attempting to..."
"Thank you for sharing, chair."
"Actually, it does look pretty roomy," said the dean, ignoring the chair's pained expression. "I vote we load up with provisions and go."
Where to?"
said Ridcully.
"Somewhere where fearsome reptiles don't suddenly turn into birds," the dean snapped.
"You'd prefer it the other way around?" said Ridcully.
He started to wade out into the water until, armpit deep, he was able to bang on the side of the hull with his staff.
"I think you are being a little obtuse, Mustrum," said the dean.
"Really? How many types of carnivorous plants are there, Mr. Stibbons?
Dozens, sir.
And they eat prey up to...
No upper limit in the case of the sapu tree of Sumtri, sir. The sledgehammer plant of Bang Bangduk takes the occasional human victim who doesn't see the mallet hidden in the greenery. There's quite a few that can take anything up to rat size. The pyramid strangler vine really only preys on other, more stupid plants. But
I just think that there's something very odd about a boat-shaped plant turning up just when we want a boat, said Ridcully. I mean, chocolate coconuts, yes, and even filter-tipped cigarettes. But a boat with a figurehead?
It's not a proper boat without a figurehead, said the senior wrangler.
Yes, but how does it know that? Said Ridcully, wading ashore again. Well, I'm not falling for it. I want to know what's going on here. Thank you.